Bitcoin causes you to value truth again. It causes you to ask the hard questions again. Truth is truly objective. It's not something that we can change. And that as we pursue truth, it's always going to be convergent of drawing people together in a similar place.
What's up, everybody? We're back with the 15th episode of the Dumbest Guy in the Room podcast, and I am your host, Eric Rao. Today we have the man himself, Joel from Untapped Growth. This is a super fun episode from the jump as we start with him showing off his herd of cattle. I know some of you may not enjoy this part as much as I did, so if that's the case, feel free to jump on forward to about the 8 or 8.5 minute mark. We cover a lot of topics on this episode: regenerative agriculture, the three base pillars of technology, how broken money deceives society, how Bitcoin can act as a universal language, and a whole lot more. I have a fun giveaway today, so make sure to listen to the entire episode for your chance to win. Thank you as always for tuning in. I hope you enjoy our conversation, and I'll catch you after the show. All right, welcome back to this episode of the Dumbest Guy in the Room podcast. Today we have a special guest. As you can hear in the background, we have the founder of Untapped Growth, a regenerative agriculture farming specialist, and the lock for the 2021 Bitcoin MV Pleb Award, Joel with Untapped Growth. How are we doing today, Joel?
Doing good. How are you, buddy?
Oh, doing great. So what surprise do you have for us to start the show off?
I'm actually out here moving the cows. They're actually all following me around, just about to put them in a new paddock. Sun setting, last little bit of the day. We had a hailstorm a couple hours ago. I was over in Yorktown, other side of the Chesapeake Bay. So I don't know how much hail we got here, but I rushed over here to check on them afterwards. I hear you, girl.
Oh, man.
Usually I can get them talking to me, the whole herd. It's like a giant cacophony. It's awesome.
They're definitely ready for some new grass, aren't they?
Yeah, they're hungry. I gave them a bunch of hay so I can get everything together earlier, which is good anyway. It's going to get some more organic matter and like a little bit of seed down in this area from that hay. But yeah, I rushed over here to check on them. And I get here and they're just chill as could be, standing there chewing on their cud, like just totally relaxed. So, I mean, the hail wasn't that big of stones over in Yorktown. Didn't even ding out my truck. But I mean, I was a little worried. But obviously these rugged cows, they kept their name. They're just nice and relaxed. Yeah, you ready? Nice. I'm gonna just call them on over. It's simple as can be, dude.
Let's do it.
I'm just gonna
And for those of you who are listening to the podcast, I'm gonna make sure to put this one up on YouTube for the first time. So check it out. You can see Joel move the cows to the new field and listen to them and see how pretty they are as well.
Come on, girls. And then they're just going to come on in, just as easy as that. Little calf. Where's the other calf? Other calf's in. Come on.
There's some well-trained cattle there.
Oh, they know. It's time to go to the new stuff. She's one of my favorites. She looks kind of African. The one in the back there at the black tip horns.
Oh, yeah.
One in the back. Her name's Sarabi. That brindle calf right there. Yeah, my farmhand named them all. I don't actually know all their names. See, can you see on the camera how that one's a little brindled? They won right next to her calf.
Okay.
Heifer now, really. I love that coat pattern. I don't know if you can see it with the sun, but that brown is actually a pattern with like a leopard black print.
Oh, wow.
It's gorgeous. I freaking love it.
I saw a hint of it there for a second. That's pretty.
Yeah, that bull calf was just born 2 months ago, 2.5. He's a little stud, man. He's already got horns coming in, thickening up. Man, he's already starting to flirt with the ladies. He'll make a good little bull.
So what's the top weight on these cattle?
That little calf back there was born probably 3 or 4 weeks ago. A couple of these girls are pregnant. You can see where they're kind of round. It's not confirmed, but I'm assuming they're pretty well bred. They've been with the bull and they've been cycling long enough. I would think they've been bred, like her back there, that tan one in the back corner. She's pretty thick. Her back there too, she looks good, that red one and the black one too. They're nice and slick, good little fat on their hips. What'd you say? I love these cows. I can go on and on about them.
Oh, they're beautiful. I see why. So I was just asking, what's the like the top end weight for these cattle?
So usually the females are like 700 to 800 pounds, maybe 900 for the big ones. The bulls can get up 1200 to 1400. Half this herd came from a bull over in Carolina. His name was Pete. He's kind of the same size. You can see how small they are. They're a lot smaller than modern cows, which is part of why they're so rugged and efficient on the forage and easy on the land. But he was the same kind of frame size as these guys, but he looked like he was on steroids, man. He was just chunky. He had deltoids and everything just popping out. So he weighed almost 2,000 pounds, and that was all on grass. So some of these got some pretty, like, a little bit more beefy genes in them. But those are a lot of the younger females here. I've not gotten any bull calves out of that genetic line yet. So I'm curious what he'll look like crossed into that genetic line. I think it's going to end up being a lot of good cows. And then I got that bull calf in the back who's early mature, and he's looking really good. I'm pretty stoked. My next step so when after he matures, Connie Woods,
when he matures, will you have to separate him out from the crew?
No, I'm going to let them compete. Which other one's got the most testosterone wins?
Natural selection right there.
Exactly. I mean, how else will I know which one's got the most vigor, right? So I keep the best bulls that are from the best females for early maturity, keeping body condition, even on the rough forage, has the most like sexual difference between the male and female. The males are more muscular, the females are more fatty. But so I'll track those, and the ones that kind of seem to be the most healthy, to slick off the best, keep the best body condition, earliest maturing, they'll be the bulls that I give the option to like compete. But then I'll let those compete with each other. Whichever one seems to be the most vigorous will be the one that gets to breed the most, and that'll be the one who kicks me out the most calves for the next year.
Awesome.
Watch out, girly.
And how heavy do the calves come out at?
For the Pawnee Woods, they're surprisingly small, but that's part of why they burst so easily, because you just like they come out at a lighter weight than most modern cows. I think, don't quote me, I think they're in the 60-pound range when they come out, but I'm not totally sure about that. I've never actually even weighed them. I don't even come out and check them when they birth. I just totally leave them out in the field, come out, there's a new cow. I'm like, oh, cool.
Wow. It's funny. When actually growing up, my family had, we would have about two Black Angus cows yearly. And then we had a herd of little boar goats as well. And so, nice. You know, seeing these guys brings me back to that, and moving them around the fields, obviously significantly less than what you had, but it was definitely a fun time to raise them. And they were a little bit bigger though, once they would get fully grown. But fun, yep. Animals to be around. And like you said, very smart and attentive, and they know what they're doing.
Yeah. These Pawnee Woods, the heritage breed cows, they seem to be a notch above modern cows as far as intelligence. And it's like, I'll watch them. They'll actually pick and graze things to like get anti-parasites if one of them's having a problem. Like I watched one of them, I had a fire pit out here camping with them one time. And one of them that was looking a little rough on her coat went and ate the ashes, which has a bunch of lye in it to clean out her stomach. Like somehow they just have a lot of ancestral memory in them, and they remember. They're super cool.
Man, that's pretty sweet. So if you want to give the listeners a little bit of background about who you are and you know, what you do, that'd be awesome.
So where should we start? What's most of your listener base? I'm assuming most of them on Bitcoin Twitter. Fairly familiar with all the comings and goings.
That, but also a lot of people who you know, aren't as into Bitcoin. You know, my friends and family who are still learning, and so it's kind of a mixture of both sides.
Okay, so I'm a Bitcoiner. We'll get into later how I found Bitcoin and became a Bitcoiner. But first and foremost, I classify myself as that as it relates to my project, everything I'm doing. And Bitcoin sets you on a journey of self-sovereignty. I mean, true freedom is equivalent to self-control, right? Not being controlled by anything except for your own choice. And when you step back and look at in our world today where everything's being co-opted against us, all the things they're trying to control are things we need to thrive as kind of free families. And like, you think about America, we used to be made up of frontiersmen where we'd go west, young man, and build a cabin and start our life in the wild. And we were very adventurous and self-starting. And it gave us a a rootedness as a nation that made us very different than other nations in the world, because we were truly independent. Like, we had everything we needed out there in the wild. We didn't depend upon supply chain, the rest of civilization, because we went out there into nothingness and made our own way. And today we've gotten so far away from that. And Bitcoiners, even though we're so like into the high tech stuff that's developing in the world, it's slowly starting to reground us, because we're developing this lower time preference that wants that deep resilience and sovereignty. And so in my own life, I started chasing that. Like, you got your foundations of sovereignty. You got like freedom over controlling your money. I mean, Bitcoin, right? That's, money is not controlled by any state authority. Money is truly free market. That's just the competitive choice of everybody trying to play this fair game and then add value to the network together. Then you got like energy sovereignty, right? So like being able to produce whatever power you need, not just power as like, as electrical energy, but heat for your home and all the different things you need for your family to be okay and thrive. And then your last step, mainly of your kind of tripod of sovereignty, is food. And we have this super fragile, very centralized supply chain that's just, oh man, like everything else, it's a deck of cards that one strong gust of wind could blow the whole thing down. And so a lot of the people in my world in Bitcoin are working on sovereignty very strongly, of advancing it in the money, advancing it in off-grid energy, but nobody was really working on the food. So I've dreamed about doing regenerative agriculture a long time. And I had this opportunity unfolding in this whole process of me also kind of becoming a true orange blood Bitcoiner. That kind of unfolded synchronously. And this whole story just kind of became where I'm out here, I'm regeneratively grazing the land, building soil. I mean, soil is like your first productive asset of humankind, right? All production and civilization starts there. If you don't have food, you don't have energy for people to think or work, and they can't go out and create anything with out of their own wisdom or value of their skills and gifts to add to the world, right? And so starting from the very ground, trying to build a parallel society, self-sovereign nuclear families, building communities all the way from the ground back up. And cattle are the trick to that. They're ruminants. They can heal the soil. Using them, we can build a parallel society of getting free again. So that's kind of where it started. But there's whole stories of why that matters that we can get into as much as you want. Is that a good synopsis? I guess like who I am on Twitter, that kind of is why I got big, is I'm taking what I know about regenerative agriculture and I've built a system to make it possible for others too, even in the midst of the broken market. That's kind of the synopsis of everything tied into a bow of what I'm doing.
Perfect. So I think a good place to start here is, for the listeners who don't know, what is regenerative agriculture and what got you into it?
Okay, so regenerative agriculture. Most of our farming today, we strip mine the soil. We come in, we extract everything we can from it to produce whatever food we can eat. We dump a bunch of chemicals on it, trying to whip it along for longer, and then it just collapses and erodes, and we move on and find somewhere else to destroy. This is terrible. I mean, the U.S., we used to have this great inheritance of the Great Plains, of this 10 or 15 feet of topsoil that were developed by the bison out there in the wild, right? Managed by the Native Americans, grazing intensively and non-selectively, migrating, letting the land rest for long periods of time and coming back. And that symbiotic relationship between like the wild prairies and the predators and then the bison and the ruminants, it created this ecosystem that just stored more and more and more living soil beneath their feet, where we had this just wealth of productive capacity. I mean, we used to be known as the breadbasket of the world, right? And we've just destroyed it through our farming practices. We create erosion. We bind up and kill. We bind up all the minerals in the soil using all the chemicals and stuff we put on it. We kill off all the soil biology, which is the foundation of the living layer that actually is the foundation for all life, like the microbiology of the fungus, the bacteria, the yeast, all those things in the soil, all the way up to the macroorganisms of like worms and dung beetles, all the way up to the birds that are part of that system, right? Regenerative agriculture is based on an understanding that soil is a living thing, not a machine to extract resources from. So it's like approaching it from a systems perspective of how do we live in symbiosis with this and store future value of productivity that's got potential for later, while also creating the energy we need of food to live today. Because we have this beautiful resource of the sun making our earth with energy infinitely all day, every day, right? And when we destroy the soil, we destroy our ability to capture and harness that energy, because the soil is the foundation of the plants to thrive. So in regenerative agriculture, it's the basis of knowing how to raise plants in such a way that rather than mining the soil and extracting it until the soil collapses, that you build soil while you produce.
Interesting. Okay, so did you study this in school, or how did you learn about regenerative agriculture and come to this understanding?
So I'm a huge fan of the Socratic method, right? Just ask the right question and then you'll find the answer. I've not read much of anything. I was around a lot of people hanging out on forums when the regenerative agriculture was first emerging. And I listened to a lot of people learning the hard way and was kind of a part of like, just kind of like, just from a distance, kind of being a part of their stories. And from that, you just eventually start learning from their mistakes, from their successes, a lot of the first principles. And as you start to think it through, it all starts to come together. And just sitting back and chewing on it, really, I discovered a lot of different things that now today, as I've been thrust into the public sphere as a speaker and influencer on this topic, I've been digging in real fast, trying to catch up on my reading, right? Like, oh no, what all these experts say, right? And it's so funny, because when you chase first principles, everything I discovered through thinking, through experimenting a little bit on my own land and stuff when I had the time, and then all my conclusions match what all the experts and their deep studies of their scholarly research has said. It's like truth is convergent. You just can't help but land in the same place. So like, answer that, like applying first principles, pure curiosity, stubbornness of making mistakes. That's how I learned most of it. That and a few influencers who really gave me the right foundations to put me on the right direction of asking the right questions.
Very nice. So I remember you, when we met, so for a little bit of background, we met in Austin, Texas after at the Bitcoin meetup at Unchained Capital. And we went over to Cooper's and we happened to start talking, and then had a great conversation about, you know, basketball, college, what you're doing now, everything. So that's a little bit of background for everybody. You told me that you learned and studied a lot of the method from a man named Greg Judy. What has he done through the years, and are you trying to emulate that? Are you working with him? How does that go?
So Greg Judy was a traditional grazer working in the mainstream cattle industry, just about lost his shirt, went broke, and kind of stepped back like, man, there's got to be a better way to do this. And he studied some of the regenerative agriculture, learning how to kind of build soil and run cattle in a system that was also good for the environment, for the land, realizing that when you work in symbiosis with nature, that you actually increase your productive capacity rather than actually, and it's not just like in the long term you increase it either. It's true, you're more resilient, you've got a better drought resistance and production for the long haul as your soil gets better. But even in the short term, like in the first handful of years, as the soil strengthens up, I mean, you're competitively more productive than your neighbors who aren't using these systems. And so he learned all that and figured it all out. But as he got deeper into it, what he realized is something that we as Bitcoiners know well. He, as a rancher, couldn't afford, I'll have to fix that when the sun sets. He couldn't afford to carry the cost of the mortgage of his property out of the farm's operating budget anymore. So land's become a store of value, right? It's monetized. It's a place where wealthy park their capital and then they hold it for long periods of time to resist inflation, and number always goes up because inflation is always going up. Which just like gold, right? When gold is treated as a money, it prices out the productive use cases. You can't use it for electronics and all these other things because the monetary premium is so high that the guys who want to use it for useful industrial purposes can't afford to. The same things happened to our farmland over the course of decades. And it squashed small scale family farms first, but it's got its way all the way up to like almost nobody can survive but your megacorps who are nursing on the government's hit. So we discovered all that and kind of sat back and like salt of the earth, first principles, wisdom, like he's known for as an old guy. I love that guy. He's like, okay, let's come up with a way to solve this. And he went and knocked on doors of all the wealthy people who had these hunting lands, conservation easements all around them out, I think it's in Missouri. And he said, hey, look, like, I know that you're regenerative agriculture. You were out on this property a couple times a year hunting deer, but then you have to do all this work of either pay somebody to manage it with tractors to keep your trails clear and keep the brush from overgrowing your property. And it's work for you and you're spending fuel and equipment. Like, you already have to pay somebody to do it. He said, let's just skip all that. Lease me your land for like a nominal dollar a year. I'll graze it, make the place look like Eden. I'll rebuild the soil, rebuild the ecosystems. The deer populations will get stronger. The bird populations will get stronger. Everything will get better. And I'll make my money on the deal for doing all that effort for you on my cattle, because now I don't have to pay for my land for running my cattle herds anymore. So these guys, they wrote up like a 10 or 15 year lease with a bunch of those local people with these hunting properties in Missouri. And after a couple of years of Greg doing it, they were so excited about how the quality of their deer improved during the hunting season, how beautiful the properties looked, and the care he was taking of their land, that they ripped up all his contracts with, said like, dude, this ain't good enough anymore. You got a lifetime lease for as long as you or one of your like students wants to use my land, it's yours. And so it became this beautiful kind of mutually beneficial relationship that kind of evolved in this thing that's just called, like, by Greg Judy, like the low cost lease grazing model. So that's something that I've emulated in my system where I'm trying to help Bitcoiners and young homesteaders who can't afford land to get back to the earth, to get self-reliant, resilient, right? As I started with the thesis of like, okay, if it makes sense for these people with hunting property and people are trying to invest in land for the wealthy people to store value, why don't we just introduce them together? Why don't we just create these deals from zero versus go try to find alignment with somebody who gets along with this whatever person and try to match them with just scattershot, right? Like, let's just create them. And so I ended up getting a low-cost lease from my farm. I ended up working with some guys that are Bitcoiners to do herd shares. So I was able to boot up my farm completely from zero. And when I did it, I had a bunch of people that were like wealthy Wall Street investors who knew my herd share investor of like, hey, like, we want to get involved in what you're doing. This is awesome. And I had a bunch of ranchers talking to me like, hey, we want to get involved. Like, how'd you build your farm like this? We want to know how you did this. And I'm just sitting there thinking like, like, maybe we should introduce these people to each other. So it all kind of piggybacks on Greg Judy's model, but it advances it to like a 2.0 stage to where we're leveraging a little bit of understanding of the larger scale economic incentives to make this possible for the long term.
Wow. So with your model, you're trying to partner ranchers with landowners. And so how does that benefit the ranchers? You know, if they already are a rancher and they have their land, what is the benefit to them?
None of the ranchers own their land. They're slowly going out of business as the banks strangle them. There's not a single one surviving. I've had a bunch call me that are pretty big name. Like, I had a guy, a big name breeder. I won't say what breed, but he provides a lot of the breeding stock of a big name breed all across the whole country. And he's done it for generations. And after he heard the podcast I did with Marty, he called me. He was like, man, I've been on the hamster wheel and I've not been able to figure out how to get off. Nobody could have come up with doing this way. We need to work together. Otherwise, my family's going to just, this farm's going to collapse. They had to sell a big chunk of their land already. They kept the cows rather than like, they had to pick between keeping the land or keeping their genetics of their cows. But the industry is so broken, it's also incentivizing them to raise the kind of cows they don't want to be raising, because the kind of cows that they in their family always raised aren't priced well by the market anymore. It's all just fiat fashion and fads that just aren't actually treating cattle like cattle. It's fiat breaks everything. It's misincentives from the ground all the way up. But yeah, that's the incentive for the rancher. And what it does is it gives you a leg up now where you don't have to be paying these interest rates. It's almost like an anti-cantillionaire attack, where through working with somebody who's in the financial world, they definancialize the world for you. So you don't have that interest rate churn, which gives you time to get ahead again and not have to play these games so that you could start to reaccumulate assets.
So they would be managing the land for the investor who buys the land, and then what's their benefit? Do they earn some of the land back, or do they just get to live on it for free, or how's that work on the back end?
Yeah, so they make the money on the cash flows of the ranch. Some of the deals with the landowners I'm talking about, they actually are, through their labor and managing the land, kind of with their work, dollar cost averaging into a couple acres that they take ownership of over so many years of doing it. It all just, they're peer-to-peer negotiations. It all depends upon those groups that are looking at, like, where's the value in working together. that depends somewhat on scale, because the land investor is making money on actually the improvement of the land as well. So not only is his land getting better, but the carry cost of the land's lower because it's now agriculture versus just being a property. So it gives you a lower tax rate, which lets you carry that property as a hard asset investment at a much better rate. There's a lot of reasons it works as well as it does.
That's pretty cool. It's cool that you're pairing the two industries as well, and it's beneficial for all parties. So one thing that you just said a minute ago about corrupted incentives, you know, with the fiat farming that these ranchers have to do currently, and it was a big topic of conversation that we had, you know, when we were in Austin, was talking about how when the communication signal is broken with the money, it leads to corrupted incentives. So could you dive into your thoughts on that, since you know, I know that's a big open topic, but I think that's pretty much where your passion lies with both Bitcoin and farming. And I think it'd be a good one to get into.
Dude, I could take that one for so long to so many different
directions. Please do. Just jump in, see where it goes, okay. And we'll chase it.
Let's unpack the thesis that I don't think I've really recorded yet. Okay, there's three mega technologies in humankind that we've had so far. I'd classify all technologies as beneath these three. The first technology is language. All technologies that we've advanced in humankind enable us to collaborate with deeper penetration and further reach. So you get better engagement, but also better spread of how far this collaboration can touch. It's almost like a tree, right? You can imagine the roots pressing deeper and the leaves branching wider, right? So now you no longer have to mime to each other and like try to figure out what each other wants. You can express desire and actually work together through engaging each other to do things. So really everything that you think about, like the printing press, the internet, like these are all advancements of the technology of language. They're the foundation of collaboration. Okay, technology number two, fire. The ability to harness energy. So it's the ability to take what you desire and accomplish more than you could based upon your own output through knowing how to steward power greater than yourself. So I'm like cover a fire pit all the way through to like gasoline and electricity for your car or gas for your house. Excuse me there. I got a phone call that came in. Am I good?
Yeah, you're good now.
I'm good. Okay. Did it blip at all?
Just start after the ability to harness energy.
Cool. Okay.
What you're saying about
so
fire.
Ability to harness energy. So that could go anywhere from like cooking your food over top of a fire pit, keeping yourself warm when it's cold, all the way through to like gasoline running your cars and fueling airplanes or electricity power in cities and nuclear reactors and all the amazing stuff you see today. I mean, those are all marginal advancements. Call it a nuclear reactor, a marginal advancement. They're all marginal advancements of fire, the technology of energy harnessing. Okay. The next technology is money. Money is a synthesis of language and fire. It's the ability to communicate about desire in a distributed manner across time and space with people you can't reach to vocally. And what you're communicating about is desire of what you want and who is most efficient to accomplish it. It's stored information and energy. So it takes language and fire and compiles them into this communication tool that's more than either one of them. That's enabled us as humankind to collaborate in a way that we couldn't do before with just language and now energy harnessing. It enables us to, in a distributed manner, to know who has the best capacity to do what without even having to have direct relation with those people, so that we can all bring our best skills and gifts forward. That way we can share the best of ourselves with each other and not have to all try to do everything. We each get to be our best self, right? Okay, and does that make sense so far? That was like,
yeah, it's the classic Breedlove example of one guy makes shoes, one guy makes hats. They trade shoes for hats rather than having to build both yourself.
Which is, it's communicating about desire and about energy, language and fire. I mean, so it's like a synthesis of the two. It's like, okay, so Bitcoin finally takes that and grounds it all the way down to making that really obvious. So you got like Henry Ford and Buckminster Fuller, and a lot of people prophesied that one day we'd have a currency based upon energy. It'd be something that is directly correlated to like this unit of exchange as an expression of energy. So like in history, like all money, all proof, money is just proof of work. It's a placeholder for energy that's been expended. That way we can share that energy together. So like let's go back to salt, this historic money. Salt was mined in these places, whether it's old seabeds or somewhere where they drug a bunch of salt water up from the shore and let it dry. And then it was carried over long distances to be shared with different cities or people groups. It was used for human health. It was used for preserving food. It had a lot of important properties, right? So the value of that salt in trade as money came from the work and energy expended to get that salt like extracted and processed and brought to the place where that salt's needed. So you think about if you're at a place where you got a like the Dead Sea and you built a city right next to it, salt's pretty cheap there because it's not a lot of energy to bring the salt to that city. So there's not much stored work in it. If you got a place like in a mountaintop that's really far away from the salt, that place, the salt is money, trades at a very high premium. Its monetary value is higher because you've got all this transport cost of getting the salt up the mountain to the city. So now you've got more stored work, more stored energy, more proof of work in the salt is money, right? So money is just stored energy. Like let's go to one of the next technologies of money that was used. Let's say cattle. So sun is energy. Energy grows the grass. Now you've got all the photosynthesis. You got that proof of work of all the biology in the soil, mining the nutrition, bringing it to the surface as calories, as fats, proteins, and carbohydrates. The cattle collect that in the ruminant digestive tract. They turn all that energy into meat and food and milk for us. And so the larger the calf, the larger the cow, the more meat on it, the more it sells for, because now it's calories to feed your family, right? Calories are energy. And cattle are really interesting because you can see some new properties of money that evolve. So the value of cattle is based upon not just how fat it is and how many calories it has as a part of it, but it's based upon like quality of the meat. It's based upon ancestral genetics of natural healthiness of the cows, of like how easy they are to keep and how well they maintain their like body condition in rough and tough environments out there in the wilds, right? It's like all of the ancestral knowledge, breeding, and wisdom that was applied to this herd of animals is now work that's encoded into their genome that's stored in them as a part of that effort, as a part of that work. So it's not just the sun energy, it's the human input of all that creative and watchful just potential to bring out the cow to be all the best of what it can be. That's all now encoded in the cow as part of its proof of work. So those cows demand a higher premium, right? So they were used as money for a long time. Now, I mean, there's reason cows aren't good money. They have a maintenance cost of having to be fed. Like cows have an age where eventually they die. They don't keep forever. So like eventually we evolved over to gold, right? Gold, like your energy of extracting it from the ground is that proof of work. And now that proof of work of everybody's using gold, to everybody who creates anything at all in the world is adding value to the network, everybody holding gold, because now you go out and make something valuable and somebody pays you gold for it. So that's value added to the network, right? So all money is just storage of energy. Okay, you with me so far?
Yeah.
Okay, what was the original question? Are we getting close to what we were trying to talk about?
So the original question, I want to go a few different ways with this afterwards, but the original question was how have corrupted incentives affected like fiat farming, like you were mentioning earlier? And yep. That's where I was going originally. And then we can jump over to the, let's touch on that. And then let's jump over to the Bitcoin side like we were about to get to.
Yeah. Okay. So we now have a money in modern society that no longer represents work. It's no longer energy. It's money that can just be fabricated at the press of a key. So what this has done is it created a world where it's based upon pure deception, really. It's we all believe we have this thing that symbolizes desire of what people around us want. And we feel like it's clear signal and energy of where the places are that need to be expending their efforts to get it or where it's what is needed most, right? That's what money does when you communicate through it. when you corrupt the energy input in the creation of money, you corrupt the communication layer of both desire, because when you have money that was costless to get, now you no longer know who really needs or wants what, because it's just information dumped heedlessly on the market that distorts the communication of desire elsewhere. It also distorts the energy of who should be expending this or who needs it most, which is encoded into the money as a communication tool itself, right? And the more you do this, the more it just breaks everything. It creates misincentives everywhere. I mean, so when you talk about cattle, let's start with just a really stupid, simple one. We subsidize the production of like corn and soy. Where that ended up impacting the cattle industry is now because of cheap money to help grow corn and soy, you've got all this extra corn and soy on the market that's cheaper. Now we have all this extra cheap inputs, so it's cheaper than feeding them rough scrub grass and actually on the land. It's better just to buy this junk industrial farm waste stuff of corn and soy. So now we rebreed all of our cattle to be cows that actually are good at eating like corn and soy. So now we have these big fat animals that aren't good at eating grass anymore. So like that one little thing cascades all the way down to where nowadays we have modern Angus that are so bad at eating grass that when they breed them into a room to extract the semen for artificial insemination, a lot of these top bulls in the country, like they can barely walk. Because when you put them out there and you put them on grass, they're so used to these high energy inputs that they're like their entire health falls apart. They can't maintain body condition or often can't even breed because they're not cows. They're corn and soy machines, right? So like that one little perversion of us thinking we know better of what's incentivize and give farmers extra money to produce this destroys the communication layer of all these people trying to say like, this is what I want because this is what's best for me. And this is how we should share our energy and work together. It creates arbitrary information that breaks trust in human society. It breaks your ability to relate to the rest of the market and collaborate. And we wonder where all this chaos and everybody being each other's throats all the time comes from, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because when you can't trust the money in the environment, you might not know exactly why, but there starts to become doubt in your head and you're wondering what's truly going on. So thanks for touching on the farming. Go ahead.
And you blame the person right in front of you, right? Like, it's like, you don't know who to blame because it's such a hidden form of disinformation that you think it's their fault that like your needs aren't getting met or that you're working your hardest going nowhere. And it creates animosity in the base layer of society. It fractures human connectivity. It's like, imagine a game of phone tag where the phone line itself, like I remember that game Telephone where you're passing it down the line, one person says something at the end, it means something totally different. Where you have just one step, you communicating to somebody else, but every time when it's at your ear, you hear a little bit of a lie, but you don't know their line and they don't know your line. How could you ever build like a society or businesses that work together with trust to like make the world a better place? You don't even realize that you're actually like trying to communicate and it's not working because the phone line itself's corrupted. That's what corrupting the money does.
And you see it in every aspect of the environment. You start to see the housing market jump by 30% year over year. And so I sold my home last October, had owned it for 3 years, and all of a sudden the value jumped up pretty significantly. And I was like, just like what you just said of the value, you know, one person thinks another person's lying to them. I was like, hey, I don't think my home's worth what the market's telling me it's worth. So I'm going to cash out and go do something else with that money, i.e. invest in Bitcoin. But it's everyone's looking at it with their own lens. And then sooner or later, people will start to see that, hey, there's something bigger that's broken. It's not the houses and it's not the land and it's not the price of beef. It's the cost to create the money is now broken. And so I think that was really big in what you talked about with, you know, you need energy to create money. Otherwise, everything is going to be broken downstream from that. So yep. What was your like original exposure to Bitcoin, and what made it click for you?
Good question. So a lot of, like, the Citadel meme in Bitcoin, right? Like getting deeper and deeper into Zarian self-sovereignty.
Really quick, for people who don't know the Citadel meme, will you explain a 10-second background to it?
Citadel meme. It's this idea that we're trying to go back to a foundation of society where, like the old saying of a man's house is his castle, right? Where we're grounded in self-sovereignty, where we have freedom in everything that we do. Citadel meme is the idea of us coming together as communities to share in the creation of that, of like a parallel world where we don't have to be connected to these systems we don't trust anymore, these systems that have dishonesty as a part of their very roots and core. That way we can build relationships and businesses and communities and families based upon truth again, rather than dishonesty.
Perfect.
Thanks. Okay. Citadel meme. So I was the very opposite of most Bitcoiners. I found Bitcoin because of building Citadels, not got into Citadels because of finding Bitcoin. So I often use this quote. When I got out of college, I was working with my buddy. We were doing a bunch of mentoring stuff with young guys, which we also did while we were in college. And this quote's defined a lot of my life. It's by Dallas Willard. He says, "The entire story of humanity is God trying to trust men with authority and power and men proving unworthy of it." Like, the integrity of the human heart is the base layer of all society. I mean, it's even deeper than the soil, right? Like, whether we love the truth and love the light and are trying to create something good in the world and add goodness and truth and beauty, or whether we're trying to spread deceit and darkness to extract value and consume it for ourselves and destroy everything we touch, right? And if we want to create a world that's better, we have to have better men again. I mean, when, like, this, and this all ties to so many things that Bitcoiners love too. I mean, you look at the breakdown of the family unit, it all collapsed when the small scale farm collapsed back in the 1970s when we left the gold standard, which forced the whole family into the workforce of treating corporate America like a god that we have to just chase the hamster wheel to stay alive versus having a long time preference of really caring about real deeper values, right? We got distracted with surviving rather than actually living. But so that was a big part of my life, of knowing that was the problem. And okay, if we want to fix that, like, we don't fix that by going out and preaching about it and trying to be loud and putting information out there. You fix that by sitting down with whatever guy's right next to you and growing together, growing into better men. I mean, first, my business partner and I did that relentlessly. Just iron sharpens iron. How do we grow? How do we become better men to steward our world around us of everything under our authority, our house? How do we make it a place that more resembles a place of beauty and goodness, right? We're good kings of our families, or our future families right now with our businesses, right? And then how do we teach other young guys how to do that? And so through that story, I mean, I got into running a small contracting company doing carpentry. Whole reason we built the company was for being able to pull guys in and do mentoring. Like, okay, you come work a summer job with us, I'll teach you how to do these skills. And in the midst of you having these real world responsibilities I delegate to you, I'm going to teach you like how to have the character to steward that leadership position well. Like, just through the bump and the grind, the friction of you screw something up, I'll redeem it, help you bail out the ship and fix it. And then I'm like, once you grow enough, I'll put you in charge of some other guys and we'll all grow together, right? In the real world by making mistakes together. And what I eventually realized through trying to do this, of growing this network, of trying to build small businesses, working with young guys, is looking at our world today, you've got so many places where the centralized authority of the government just doesn't like you growing into being a sovereign king, right? Like, they want control of you. So like, you got small businesses now where if you don't deposit your cash into the bank account in the right amounts, they'll hit you with a cash structuring charge and they'll seize all your assets in your bank account. And so like, there's so many innocent like small business owners who have had a lot of bullshit like that happen to them. And so I'm looking at this kind of unfolding world of self-sovereign kings who really love freedom and ruling their things well, right? And I'm realizing like, self-sovereign freedom is going to clash with state authority at some point as these men keep growing. Like, what am I going to need so that we can win that clash when it happens to just not get squashed? And I started asking a lot of questions of like, okay, what do I trust in? All these different things. Is this something reliable or my trust is placed? And one of the questions I was asking was about money. Like, how does my money work? Is this something I can trust? And is this something we can trade in securely without it being censored, like trying to be weaponized against us? And the answer was no. So I started digging deeper, wondering first, like, okay, I need to fix this. But before I try to fix it, like, maybe somebody out there is working on it. And lo and behold, somebody was working on it. I found Bitcoin, everything that you know that it is. And that was my end to Bitcoin. I found it back in like July of 2019. I'd say it took about 6 months to really get all the way down the rabbit hole to really get to where I classed myself a hardcore Bitcoiner like I am now. Well, like, what do you say, a Bitcoiner, somebody who has 100% of their net worth in Bitcoin or more?
I don't know if that has to be the case to be a true Bitcoiner, but there, you know, I think 100% of the belief in Bitcoin, you know, because we got guys like Greg Foss, who, that guy's a Bitcoiner, but he probably doesn't have 100% of his net worth in Bitcoin. That's a pretty cool story of how, go ahead.
I'd be surprised if he didn't, to be honest. I mean, you got guys like Plan B. I mean, they're doing carry trades. I mean, this is how the financial world works today. You borrow in a weak currency and you save in a stronger. A lot of these guys, I mean, they can afford the carry costs and the interest rates out of their just productive salaries. So there's not any real exposure risk, but like, you end up being more than you own in it really quick before you realize it, because it's the only smart, like, responsible decision. It's really goofy. That's what happens when you use interest rates to steal time from people. Eventually you run into something hard enough you can't steal from it.
Could not agree more. Obviously, Michael Saylor has figured that one out, you know, before the rest of Wall Street. So we'll see that continue to play out over the next few years for sure. So what was your initial exposure to Bitcoin? Like, did you happen across it? Did somebody tell you about it as you started researching more into the money? And then what was your first gut reaction?
So everybody has their touch points, right? I remember, like, back in 2017 or 18, little friends telling me, like, I heard the word Bitcoin, but never really looked into it, right? I heard the word mining, but never really looked into it. Just kind of assumed when it popped, there was nothing really there. I mean, but I didn't really look at it hard enough to even know. In 2019, when I started digging, the thing that came across my, like, my dash that made me look at Bitcoin was Flexa doing their payment stuff of doing payment rails for cryptocurrency into actual real world businesses. And I was like, okay, there's something interesting here. If you got a company with this much capital raised talking about this kind of stuff. And that got me started digging into Bitcoin. And at first I was just looking at cryptocurrencies in general, as a lot of us do. It didn't really see through all the noise, but when you dig hard enough, you start to realize where the truth is versus when everybody's just trying to repeat the same centralized control of, if I make money, I can extract wealth from everybody, versus the Bitcoiners are the people who speak the truth to kind of take care of everybody together. Rise together rather than me get relatively off of you.
Yeah, it's a cool community for sure. You know, wanting to help and see others succeed, and it's pretty crazy just like how deep the rabbit hole goes with, one, the Bitcoin rabbit hole, but two, the fiat rabbit hole on the other side of what's truly going on. And you know, like you said, once you start to see it, you can't really unsee it. You know, because you just start going down it every which way, and you're seeing the food industry, which you had already, you know, started to look into, and there's quite a bit going on there. I want to go back to your three main technologies that you were referring to between language, fire, and money throughout human history, because this is a topic to me that's been very front of my mind, and was actually probably the majority of the conversation that we had in Austin. So the three main technologies that you mentioned were language, fire, and money. And I think personally, the base root of everything is the combination of language and money, because that is how you can communicate with one another. And I've started to almost view Bitcoin as the first universal language. And that was something that, you know, we had a great conversation about. I wish, too bad we don't have that recorded, because I was we went down some awesome rabbit holes that day. But one thing that you mentioned earlier about language was the ability to collaborate with deeper engagement and further reach. And when you start to look at Bitcoin as a universal language, because everyone is on the same monetary standard, we have the furthest engagement and reach possible throughout the world, because everyone is looking at it the same way. You know, it's not $1 equals €1 or, you know, 1.5 euro or whatever the conversion rate may be. And then we're trying to have a conversation and it's whose government printed more money that day. It's no, one Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin. And it's the same.
Because it's an absolute zero of energy, not of political fashion of who has the more power to get away with more theft.
Exactly. So what do you think that will mean for like humanity and like the human race of what we can accomplish when language starts to be universal in the form of the money? That's a broad question, I know. And I know your mind can go to some pretty crazy places with it. So I'd love to hear it.
So two ways I'd love to take this. One, I know your background. Would your audience mind if I think like a little theological for a second?
No, not at all.
I've not talked that way on a lot of podcasts. This will be one of the first. So when we talk about expression of desire is language and power, and you think about like depth of manifestation with like penetration and reach, it makes me think of this idea in like the biblical scriptures of logos. Like in the beginning was the word, and nothing came into being but that was spoken by the word, right? Like this idea that creation itself was spoken word. So you like you even think about quantum physics, right? Is it energy or is it matter? Well, everything's kind of both. So like we, as we're ascending with these human technologies, we're getting deeper and deeper as I'd argue sons of God to manifesting ultimate logos, to beginning to reflect that ability to have the power to where our speech actually is a creative force that shapes reality itself. It's like we're becoming more like gods. But like Bitcoin has this really cool rabbit trail. I got to share this. It's like Bitcoin has this really cool property though, because it's like emergent truth with a relentless opportunity cost. Like Saifedean says it so well. There's no escaping the consequences of somebody else holding harder money than you. And it has this really cool nature of, it forces you to submit to truth. And it, the more you try to kick against it, the harder it punishes you. and it builds this humanity in you of this humility to submit to something larger than yourself. And it's really beautiful when you look at the Bitcoin community, the impact that has. You got a lot of young guys returning to want to start families. They're returning to like reading some historical philosophy. They're grounding themselves deeper in some of the more ancient sciences and mathematics. And it's freaking beautiful what it does, because it's like in the fiat world, it's all about trying to think that we can build this, another religious analogy, this Tower of Babel, where we can be gods, but what gods means is we can extract our will from the world without consequence. And that's just not true. And Bitcoin reminds us of that, which goes to my second point. This universal language of energy stored in the money, with Bitcoin having this direct connection through proof of work, one of the most amazing things it does is it puts a price on energy. Okay, so like that seems really simple and stupid at first, but like Bitcoin eats wasted energy. It puts a price on energy anywhere it can find, and it'll continue to go and unlock new energy sources because it's hungry. Okay, your first instinct is to think like, oh no, that's bad. Bitcoin's going to consume all the energy of the world. That's not true. So because Bitcoin is energy source indifferent, anybody who has a societally useful need for that energy that has less adaptability of energy they could use to do what they need to do is always going to outprice Bitcoin for that energy, because Bitcoin's location and source indifferent. It'll just go find somewhere else that's cheaper, right? But when you combine that with the fact that Bitcoin unlocks stranded energy, it creates this new world where rather than energy being based upon like a network of hardware and infrastructure, where you got these first world societies that are connected through the energy grid, you got the power and transmission cables, the nuclear power plants, the step down transformers connected to your house, right? And like all these things that create this society that's kind of its own little bubble. And then you got these other societies that are completely disconnected and at a competitive disadvantage because we use our energy levers to extract resources from them for ourselves, right? It's an unfair competition. What Bitcoin does, it's a it's a buyer of last resort for stranded energy, and it goes and unlocks those energy sources. It incentivizes investment in these places where, like AKA volcano mining, right, down in El Salvador. Like, let's go tap into the geothermal energy and create this place where we can mine Bitcoin, because now this is cheap energy. But what's going to happen is society, cities, civilizations, they always build around energy centers. I mean, you think about like where I am in Virginia, like Richmond, our capital. Richmond was originally built because it's an energy center. It was the cheapest place to ship goods up the river because it's the fault lines. It's where the rapids start. So the energy efficiency of transportation of all the goods they needed for spreading out to all the cities stopped here. Now you have to put in the wagons. So the fault lines became the definition of the energy center the city was built around. Okay, now go back to volcano mining. You've now unlocked an energy center. Society is going to start to congregate around that, like organically and emergently. Now, what we know about Bitcoin, Bitcoin always gets priced out by anybody who has a need that can't be just met by anything anywhere. So that society will start to price out Bitcoin. Now that Bitcoin unlocked the energy source, that society will grow and blossom. So now Bitcoin will go somewhere else, unlock a new energy source until you find an equilibrium. So we'll get away from this system where you have this first world energy culture that's almost like yeast life, where it's just like extract, 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 consume, 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 and then it grows, grows, grows until it pops because there's nothing, no more energy left to extract, right? To become more of this like healthy fungal network type of energy, like civilization, where Bitcoin will unlock energy in places that have energy that is a reasonable cost to unlock it. Society will blossom there, and then Bitcoin will go somewhere else. And then in addition to that, Bitcoin puts a price on wasting energy. Anywhere you waste energy now has a punishment cost to it because it's an opportunity cost for Bitcoin. It puts a floor on the cost of energy. So not only are you unlocking new energy, enabling the birth of new civilizations, but you're actually punishing those who waste energy and driving up the price of energy. So the price of energy is increasing for those who are wasting it. It's decreasing for those who don't have access to it. And the whole world's coming to a better equilibrium. You with me on all that so far?
Yeah. Yeah. You got so, more?
You know, so much more. So like, good. So like as an environmentalist, like I think about one of the greatest wasted energy sources in all humanity is our deserts. We strip the topsoil through erosion. We've had all the life just depleted from these zones, and it's creeping across our world. So now we got all the sun energy baking the earth and just reflecting back off into the black recesses of space where nobody has any sort of use out of it at all. We, with our current world, we treat energy like everything has to be turned into electricity. But it's because we're so indifferent about wasting it. Like the meme would be the example of a diesel generator charging a Tesla charger and then that Tesla going out driving, right? Like now your miles per gallon of diesel is like 6 miles a gallon or something, which my big old one-ton truck does better than. And like, because we're foolish in our relationship with energy because we, once again, bad information, right? You got subsidies that drive the electric car market, which makes that price of energy seem cheaper. And the price of running my truck seem more expensive when actually the energy equation is totally different. Okay, so we convert everything into electrical and we waste a lot in the process. When you have a price on wasted energy, those stupid conversions between one form of energy or another start to get really expensive. That's a beautiful thing. Because like go back to our original idea of like calories being a form of money because it stored energy in the cattle, right? Like, so now rather than us going around the world trying to install solar panels to extract electrical energy out of the deserts at a completely inefficient rate, because not only are solar panels supported by subsidies and slave labor and depreciate faster than they could even produce electricity and all this stupidity, like solar panels are ridiculously inefficient compared to forage of grasslands and like actually good crops and trees at capturing solar energy. So imagine rather than converting it to electrical energy, we're now incentivized because wasting energy is punished to grow the soil back, grow good pasture lands, raise cattle, and now we have caloric energy of food. That I can't even fathom the number of places that's going to change civilization to where it causes us to respect energy conversions and harness energy into its most efficient form and not waste transitions between them. That in itself is going to lead to a renaissance of environmentalism. Like I can't even think of what the other kind of things that'll change will be. Like, that's just one little example in my world that I can bend my brain around. But good Lord, that's going to have like massive implications.
Most definitely. It'll be awesome to watch. Somebody said on a podcast I was listening to the other day of, you know, in the next 10 to 20 years, we should see about 100 years of growth. And then, you know, on my episode with Guy Swan at the very beginning, he talked about the changes that we see in the next 10 years are going to dwarf the changes that we've seen in the last 25, which I think is just incredible to think about with how far we've come with the internet and cell phones and data transmission and data storage around the world over the last 25 years. It's going to be uncomparable to what we see in the next 10 to 15 years because of Bitcoin unlocking, one, new forms of energy, but two, just making life have to be more efficient, because otherwise someone's going to be doing it better and a company's going to get priced out of the market because they can't compete with another company who's, you know, using nuclear energy to run a Bitcoin miner and then power a city around it. It's crazy and it's hard to wrap
But not just more expensive to where people are incentivized not to waste, but more accessible and fair, where everybody gets access to a level playing field because it's unlocking wasted sources or untapped sources. Like, it's going to be a level playing field with this healthy, more symbiotic fungal type network relationship than we've ever seen before in humanity. It like mind blowing. Like, I can't, like, the level of change that happened with our grandparents to watch the emergence of the internet is going to be the change that we're going to watch to see the emergence of Bitcoin, but probably even greater, like exponentially greater.
And faster.
Trying too. To fathom, wrapping my head around that is just, yeah, exactly. It's just freaking mind blowing.
Completely agree. It's, I mean, you get a lot of excitement when you're in Bitcoin, just thinking about the future, and it gives you, you know, hope when there's that sound money. And for the first time, you know, we have something that is language, the code of Bitcoin, and is energy, the mining of Bitcoin, combined into money, which is how we transfer Bitcoin. And, you know, we had, you know, probably, I don't think throughout history there's been anything that can really compare, because, you know, gold would have been energy to produce, but, and then it's defined as money, but there was no real language associated with gold. And the, you know, over time, the energy to produce.
I would say there's language, because it's the communication mechanism of desires and efficiency. It just doesn't have the same low friction ability to transmit that information across time and space that Bitcoin does. It had like a higher resistance coefficient, essentially. So it ended up being communication more locally versus globally. This is the first time we can communicate efficiently globally, because gold was restricted by its transportation.
There you go. Okay. That's fair. That's better framing for that for sure. Yeah, it's just, it's really exciting. It's very bullish to see, you know, like what's going to happen in the future with the way that Bitcoin's going to push us forward. What is it that you're most excited about developing in the Bitcoin world? Not you personally developing, like what is developing that you're most excited about in the Bitcoin atmosphere?
Pleb culture.
So you're the MV pleb of 2021. So what does pleb culture mean to you?
I don't know if I deserve that title. I'm but a peer, you know. I'm a peer among men that I'm honored to be a part of. Like, with Bitcoin, it causes you to respect truth again, where you're punished by the opportunity cost relentlessly, like we've talked about. It causes you to be humble and submit to that. It causes you to reframe your life to this hard grounding of realizing truth matters again, because you're no longer partnered to this Tower of Babel society of let me extract top-down control and think I can get away with it. But like, how do I respect the underlying first principles and collaborate with the emergent properties in a way that's healthiest, right? Like, the implications of what that means for having a generation of men who respect truth again is like honor and integrity reawakening. that to me makes me want to go home and cry at night. Like having real brothers that I'm finding that truly care about that again. Like that's this emergent society we have of us here as the early Bitcoiners, like we're the black sheep that have stood hungry for truth in a world that's relentlessly burying us in FUD and misinformation. And like a lot of people talk about Bitcoin, right? Like Bitcoin takes advantage of human greed. But so many of us, like we're here and we have every incentive to be a part of the misinformation, to take greater financial advantage of this. I'm starting to get, you know, why I have mosquitoes, but I can't shut my door because then the lights go out. So like, if we really take that as absolute truth, that like it's only taken advantage of broken humanity to create a greater consensus of us all that's good for us, I think we're really missing one of the elements of this, is that like Bitcoin has been founded on altruism from the very beginning. It's part of the key cornerstones that has made it what it is. Like Satoshi made a very fair release. He publicized it, he gave everybody a chance to do it. He like made sure everybody was capable of mining. He turned his miner on and off to give a fair chance for everybody else to get blocks. Like you look at the progression through with Laszlo, the pizza guy, there's like speculation that him and Satoshi had a conversation, that he was the first guy to mine with graphics cards. And Satoshi was like, buddy, you got a lot of the network under your power now. Like it's probably good to start like sharing this and spending some of it. That way, like we can have this equitable balance where we help bootstrap, like having everybody step into this together with us, because they understood that if one person controlled all this, you don't have the value of the network. The network is everything. The brotherhood of the community doing this together is everything. That's the, like, as Bitcoiners call it, the immaculate conception, that consensus, the emergent properties of that togetherness of us working with this ossification of the network layer. That's where the magic is. And that's been defended by altruism from the very beginning. And we defend it every day as toxic maximalists who stand up against the shitcoin scammers, right? And living with a group of guys that have stood for that because they believe in what the good this will do for humanity is, and these being the guys that I'm getting wealthy with as the movers and shakers, the next generation of the new elite class is going to change the whole world, that gives me so much hope of what society is going to look like as we ascend together. Guys who care about that first and have been tested in the fire to care about that first and have seen each other tested in the fire to care about that first, to where we've shed blood and we know who's who and we'll collaborate together to just continue advancing this world of truth, because we know that we'll grow the best value for the network together as we do so. That's what makes me excited about Bitcoin. It's not the tech, it's what's changing with people.
Yeah, I think that's very beautifully worded. All right. So the deeper question I had is, we talked a little bit about theology and religion earlier. So I'm Christian, and I, with looking at Bitcoin, I think it helps promote Christianity and the message that I believe in the world of God sacrificing his son for humans and their eternal being. That's probably a pretty poor way to phrase it, but there it is. And so I see Bitcoin actually helping get people back to understanding, you know, that God gave us the gift of life. And I don't necessarily view Bitcoin as a quote unquote gift from God. I view it as, you know, a creation by humans. I know some people have gotten to the side of almost viewing Bitcoin as its own religion to an extent. What are,
like,
your thoughts?
Like Eric Kaysen with like Bitcoin's messianic.
Exactly. And that's not the way I believe. I believe in the one true God and him sacrificing his son and Jesus for the saving humanity, and Bitcoin being something that helps humans refocus on that as having sound money and being able to focus on the future again. I'd love to hear your thoughts on theology, because clearly you know theology and you have some sort of background in that, whether it's being raised in the church or whatnot. But I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on that as well.
Well, first, if you're
willing to share on a podcast.
Yeah, I could talk about it some. But first, like, about whether or not it's messianic or like whether like that whole idea, any truth that's deeply true kind of manifests principles that's larger than itself. Like we were just talking about Bitcoin kind of being resembling of logos. Like if you define logos as like ultimate spoken desire manifested into life itself, right? Like advancement into truth and Bitcoin starts to bring us as men closer to that reality where we can resemble that ourselves, right? Like to me, that's true of any truth. Truth speaks of a story larger than itself. My background, I grew up Christian. Like a lot of Bitcoiners, I'm a black sheep because I've relentlessly asked questions. You guys won't find this surprising, especially considering the last week or two. In high school, I got a detention for and I quote, stirring up discontent and inciting riot amongst students. I went to detention for that. One of my two detentions in my life. I brought that home to my dad and he laughed.
Well, we have to hear the story. What discontent and riot did you stir up?
So I've always been a little bit autistic. I've learned to get a little better at it as I've gotten older to kind of like overcome some of it. But like when my dad raised me, like my dad is really smart. But he's also got this thread of kind of childlike wonder that runs through him, where like he just has this relentless curiosity that's really beautiful. I love that about my dad. And so like when I was a little kid, like even like ages 3 or 4, like there was no question my dad wouldn't just joyously unpack for me. And that was the world I grew up in, was used to. And it was really funny because I was as stubborn then as I am now. Like I would ask a question like, why is the sky blue? And it's so funny hearing my mom and dad tell the stories about it, because if they gave me a half-ass answer, I would just look them in the eye and I would think for 3 or 4 seconds and I would just repeat the question. It was like my childlike way of being like, this is bullshit. I don't believe you. I'm asking again. Like, like I just would ignore everything they said. Like, this isn't true enough for me. So my dad really, like, he learned that with me as a kid, like he would sit down and just, even as a 3 or 4 year old, he'd take the really advanced science and break it down for me. Like, okay, air, like light, when it shines through the air, it kind of bends a little bit. The more moisture in the air over certain distances, the more it bends. When it bends, it shows different colors. The color in the spectrum it shows over the sky as a whole is blue. And a sunset, you see red. He'd explain it all to me. And so me and my 3-year-old, 4-year-old little self, I'd just kind of be there, like, listening, chewing, maybe 5 or 6. I don't really know what I was at that question. But I kind of just chew on it and kind of thoughtfully. And my dad said that, like, when I was a kid, I would just relentlessly ask questions 24-7. And the only way to ever get me to shut up was to tell me the truth. I'd go sit in a corner by myself and think about it for a while. And I would just ponder it and I'd come back with the next question. And my dad was so cool too, because like sometimes the next question wasn't another science question. It's like, okay, I get this. I get how the sky is blue, but why is the sky blue, Dad? Why? And my dad would be like, well, blue is beautiful because it speaks to us of like exploration and joy and wonder and being awake and alive. It draws you into like questing out an adventure of like finding whatever joyous thing you need to do for the day, like stirs that part of your heart. And I'd go sit down and think about that. Like, I think blue does that to me. That's beautiful. I like this answer. It's a gift. Like, this is a gift from Creator, and that's why he made it blue. I like this, you know? And so that was my whole life growing up. Like, that's what my dad did to me for absolutely freaking everything. Like, that was who I was. And there was never a space where it wasn't okay to be like that. I could ask any question about any topic, like whether it was something my dad had built, like maybe even if it had broke, I'd be like, Dad, why the hell did that thing break? What'd you fuck up? You know, like, and he, like, no ego. He just talked me through it. Like, here's where I screwed it up. You know, like, that was my family. Freaking beautiful. Loved it. Black sheep thing started later, where I got into trouble with my family. Like, as I, like, senior high school going out to college, that's where things went sideways. But my early childhood was fantastic. So I inherently brought that expectation to school. I mean, I'm a little young guy. I'm relentlessly curious. I got a super intelligent dad. He's taught me to be pretty smart. So, like, I'm always really curious. Like, okay, you teach me this. Like, why does that work? And how does this connect to the other thing, like, over here that I learned in this other class, right? And in high school, I had a chemistry teacher. It was her first time teaching chemistry, and she wasn't very good at it. She didn't really know her stuff very well. And the whole class was frustrated with her because they weren't learning. But at the time, I didn't realize that because I was socially awkward and slightly autistic, but very fixated on just being curious and wanting to learn. And I'd spent a lot of the last months like helping some of my fellow classmates learn what was going on, kind of like making sure they were picking up the information. And sometimes she put things on the board that just weren't true. And so she's out there giving a lesson, and she was just kind of wrong again, but I wasn't sure that she was actually wrong. So I asked the question, like, but what about this and what about that? And I don't, this just really doesn't make sense to me. And when I asked it, the entire class just fucking exploded, because all the pent up frustration of a semester of failing tests when the teacher was freaking horrid, like, came out of like a firestorm, and they all just railed at her. And I was looking around like, what did I just do? You know, like, I just was trying to learn. And so, like, she just blamed me for all that chaos. And this has been a common theme of my life thus far. And so she gave me detention for it, and I had to go and write a lesson about in detention about, like, how I won't start riots anymore. But, like, so, like, the same thing's been true about me when it comes to religious circles. Like, I, like one of my buddies, he's a Marine, he has a saying, like, he goes, like, I have a life philosophy. I shake things until they break so I can know what's real. I'm like, yeah, that kind of describes me as well. And I did the same thing in every circle I was a part of that had any sort of, like, religious connotations to it. And I've been kicked out of pretty much every religious circle I've ever been in for most of my life. But, like, it's led me to a place where I built real community of men and mentors around me that very few, I mean, granted, most guys hated me for doing it because it exposed places they didn't know the truth. But the few I've found have been phenomenal men. And we've built a little community around ourselves of guys that have integrated, like, our heart and our emotions, our intellect, our spirituality, our physical worlds, and what we steward as kings of our little domains, and try to draw that into unity every day of pursuing truth and all of it. That's kind of where I stand spiritually, is Bitcoin causes you to value truth again. It causes you to ask the hard questions again. Truth is truly objective. It's not something that we can change. And that as we pursue truth, it's always going to be convergent of drawing people together in a similar place.
I like that a lot. Yeah, I think that's pretty cool. You know, drawing those around you together that are looking for and searching for truth, that's a special way to look at it for sure.
Because it's directional, right? Either you're pursuing life and growing and becoming more integrated, like another religious thing. The Lord your God is one. That word "one" used in the Old Testament of Scripture is, like, integral, integrated. Like, you can see any one of his parts of his character, and it doesn't clash with any other. It's got complexity to it, but it's got integration and wholeness within itself. So, like, as we as men pursue integration in our lives of who we are and what we believe and what we do in our actions, you're always going to find places that are out of alignment with that, and you'll have to wrestle with them until you find the place that's true. And then as that grows in breadth, you just become more and more of a man. So that, to me, is a beautiful journey where either you're growing towards greater integration and greater expansiveness of being, of bringing your full self, of your spirit, your heart, your mind, your body, and your physical matter all to the same place together, or you're dying and you're regressing, you're not growing, you're becoming less. And any man or friend who's on that journey and growing towards becoming more, I am an ally and a brother, and I'll help you do anything you can to get there. And I hope that they'll do the same for me. And that's what I care about. I don't care where we start. I care that we're moving towards that together.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And you definitely see that with your personality and shine through of, you know, like, Pleb Strong and the brotherhood and the foundation in that way. And kind of actually on that topic, I think it'd be maybe a good chance if, do you mind talking about the whole situation that happened with, I believe you say it, Aceris, or do you want to wait on that?
Honestly, I don't want to waste any time talking about it all anymore.
That's very fair.
I'm ready to get back to build, man.
Perfect.
I've spent enough time dealing with that to where if you can't see what's happening at this point, it's not worth me arguing with somebody to convince them.
Definitely. I'll make sure to link your article in the show notes as well, so that people who don't know what happened can read and understand and, you know, see what what he was trying to do and take from you and what you're building. And it goes right back to what you were just speaking on of building something together with people who have a unified vision and, you know, working together to build and get back to build. And that is your message to a T. And, you know, it comes through in the what you've written. It comes through in what you've said on podcast and on this episode. And it's pretty cool to see that fall in line completely throughout.
I'll say this one thing. The difference between a lawyer and a small business owner is very stark. And I'm not saying this directly to Arceris or anybody in general, but just worldview of people in different fields. Lawyers build their lives around trying to erode you into a place where they have leverage of a gotcha, of something that they've caught you in, of an agreement about something. It's all based around extracting contractual power, right? Versus me as a small business owner, my livelihood has been built around communicating clearly with my customers, where everything's based upon us having clear understanding together of what everybody wants, where everybody is, and what's being done. And gotchas just don't win anything in that world. Because at the end of the day, my livelihood's based upon them feeling like I've respected and created value for them so that they pass my name on to somebody else so I can do it all over again.
Most
and
definitely.
We've done that successfully in our community for many, many years. If you dig into my story, if somebody tries to like use my name to kind of dox me some, I mean, my customers, like, we become family, man. Because like our contracts, they're super, super simple. They're geared towards not legal verbiage, but towards this is where we all are. This is what each of us are responsible for. This is as clear as it could possibly be versus us like trying to extract leverage on one another. It's built around trying to be faithful to good communication and collaboration. That's a very different worldview. And fiat world is much about this contract legal worldview. Pleb world is all about honor of working together with clarity of protecting relationships for long-term value creation. This story, I think, is a really good example where you can see the contrast between those two.
I completely agree. And one thing that you said there is a lawyer's worldview is shaped around entrapment and trapping somebody into winning and losing. And have you seen the movie Arrival?
I've not.
Okay, first thing, you should watch it. My shameless plug, love that movie. It's a great one. I was actually just talking about it on my last podcast with CJ Wilson.
Is that the one with the alien ship and then the girl who was Lois Lane in the Superman movie?
Correct. It is that one.
Okay.
I think it's on Amazon right now, so you should check it out. But what's really interesting in that movie is they're trying to learn a language, right? And so in learning the language, I can't remember her name in the movie, but the main character is teaching the aliens the human language by fundamentals and basing it around how do I get them to understand an overarching question? And then they find out that I believe it was the Chinese group that was trying to do the same thing and communicate with the aliens is they're teaching the aliens their language by teaching them to play a game. But mm-hmm. by teaching them to play a game, everything is looked at as a move to win or a move that could beat the other person. And so framing your thought process looks completely different. And so when you as a small business owner, you come to teach someone how to ask a question and how to understand what question's being asked, and someone else comes in of how to entrap an opponent so that they win, it is a completely different playing field and you're not going to come to the same conclusions, you're not going to come to the same results, and you actually don't even have the same goals. And that's the most important thing is the goals and the misalignment of incentives, the misalignment of everything going on at the fundamental level. And it is crazy how everything is pretty circular in this world. And you know, if you build from the foundation of having a strong foundation and having something good and whole, you can build your reputation, you can build your business, you can build everything that needs to be built on top of it rather than just winning and losing. Because if to be a winner, there's always going to be a loser. And that's not the way that we're trying to look at the world. We're trying to help others to grow and win as well, win with each other rather than yep. win in spite of each other.
Yep. Have you ever seen the movie Dances with Wolves?
I have not.
With Kevin Costner?
I have not.
One of my so he was an army like scout or whatever. And one of my favorite scenes, he's at this outpost and he meets this Native American tribe. And it's kind of first contact for them in some ways between actually like white man world and Native American world. And you get to witness the story of them kind of learning with each other. And they got this whole miming thing trying to say like Tatanka, like buffalo, and he makes some coffee and grinds it. They're kind of acting everything out and talking to each other and trying to learn each other's words. And like I experienced this in like high school and college, working on landscaping crews and different like contracting jobs too, working with like Mexicans who spoke Spanish and not much English. When you're trying to learn a language with somebody, it either becomes frustrating where you want to just like beat each other's faces in, or you default to this base level humanity of humor of like where you extend good faith to each other in this like kind of ambassador like relationship where you make it like all the little missteps are a joy and you giggle at each other together. Like that part of discovery is a beautiful thing. And so like you look at first people's contacts between different culture and language groups, like you either have violence, which is that other extreme, or you have that joy of the emerging of like two worlds wanting to share value together. I wish I knew how to take that magic of that joy that unfolds when you're with a person learning that new stuff together of a new language and help that grow into more humanity as a whole. Because that place is like a childlike place of wonder that changes so much in your heart as like, as even a worldview of the way you approach other things in life too.
I completely agree. It's like, I think back to, you know, you're traveling around the world and you're meeting people who don't speak the same language and you're at a bar and you're having drinks, and you're sitting at a table and you understand very few words, but you're just laughing and having the best time. But at the end of the day, you haven't conversed. You've just like shared time and experience together. And it's a truly a beautiful thing that's pretty, I think probably pretty unique to humans for the most part, because every once in a while you see two animals kind of bond that are of different species, that, you know, like a cat and a dog that just like hang out all the time, or, you know, maybe you got two farm animals. But with humans, it's the
dog
language.
And a duck.
There you go. And with humans, yeah. It's the language, because we're all humans. We're all the same species. And then we just start to realize like, hey, we can just like hang out. We can converse in our own special way. We can have a great time together and we can both understand that we don't understand each other and just kind of have fun with it. And it's a special place to be. I completely agree. I'll have to check out Dances with Wolves and you'll have to check out Arrival.
Yeah, it's a good movie. But like in that context, right? Like language is a place for the expansion of the bandwidth of the joy. You desire to speak each other's language because you want the bandwidth of the joy to grow, so you have just more capacity to share it together. Like it's almost like romance in a mythic sort, like not in a sexual kind of way. Like you got a husband and a wife or a couple that comes together. Like out of all oneness comes creation. You have this shared joy together, and out of that shared joy of oneness bursts a new life so they can share that love with another party, with that child. It's like love of that shared joy always wants to share more of itself with others. That's a place that when we settle into our deepest humanity, we begin to become co-authors who tell of that joy to all of each other together. That's what I think humanity will become as we all submit and respect truth together with humility, where we're not seeking to extract things from each other, but simply discover how can we collaborate to create the most value and joy and beauty in the world.
Yeah, I think that's very well said and beautifully put. You know, it's truly special when humans can start to bond together, because that's where, you know, like you just said, creation and beauty is built, is in the bonds. And, you know, we're meant to have partners in life with, you know, a marriage relationship and also friendships. We aren't meant to live life alone in a cave in the wilderness. I mean, there may be some people out there that is what they desire. But as a whole, humanity is built for relationships. And we seek that. Like, you have your cattle that you have a friendship with. I have my dog that is laying 6 inches behind my chair and goes with me everywhere I go, because we have a friendship and a bond. And at the core, every human wants that and desires that. And animals want that too, clearly, because, you know, dogs and cows, they clearly love you and they come to you and follow you and you lead them. And it's beautiful, the relationships that you can build. And, you know, I look back at our messages. In Austin, we sent a photo together after we had just talked for, you know, an hour plus. And I believe you said something along the, "We're going to be brothers," was your response back. And it was just like, you just know when you like bond with people of, hey, this is a cool relationship and a person that like we're on the same goal and we're pushing towards the same things. And I think that's a cool thing to see in humanity as a whole. And I think Bitcoin's going to help improve that by giving us that universal language of a shared understanding.
Have you ever read much C.S. Lewis?
I've seen a couple of the movies. I wasn't much of a reader when I was growing up, so I'm actually a very slow reader. I get frustrated, and especially at a younger age, I got very frustrated with reading because my comprehension was high, but it just took me a long time. So like the thing I always think back to is we would sit on an airplane or in a car, and my sister, avid reader, was very fast. I could get about 3/4 of a way done with the first page by the time she would flip the second. So I'm a slow reader, but audiobooks have been huge for me over the past few years. And that's where podcasts really draw me in, because I can ramp those things up to 1.5 times speed, 2 times speed, depending on the speaker, and absorb more information. And I catch all of it, but I can't learn it by visual.
Visually, I'm the opposite.
So exactly. So we have our strengths and our weaknesses there. And like, so I love the audio feedback, and that's actually in college. I got significantly better grades once I quit trying to take as many notes, because I was absorbing more by just listening and understanding rather than trying to write down every word and read it later, because I would never go back and read it. And then I just miss everything because I try and write it. So what about C.S. Lewis?
I can see that in conversation with you, because I can kind of see you like repeat that to yourself as we're talking. C.S. Lewis has this really cool statement about friendship. It's something along the lines of like, a friendship is born when you meet another person and you discover you see the same beautiful thing that I do.
I like that a ton.
Yeah, I do too.
That's super cool. That reminds me of a quote. So I had this buddy in college. He was my teammate. Big goofy dude. Love him to death. And he saw the world differently. And I always made a point, you know, I got to know him after the first couple years or first year of college, and he was a year older than me. And I started to realize his mind just worked differently than everybody else's. And so I'd always ask him why he did things. And because his answers were well thought out and were very intriguing, and they were different than the way anyone else thought. And one day he sat next to me. It was just the two of us. We went down to the cafeteria and we're sitting there, and he sat right next to me. And I was like, well, that's kind of weird. Usually you sit across from each other. And I just didn't think much of it. And then a couple of days later, same scenario, he did the same thing. He sat right next to me. And I looked at him and I said, hey, why'd you sit next to me and not across from me? Because I wanted to know. He had a reason. He did it twice. And he, without missing a beat, taking a bite of his food, he goes, I wanted to see the same things as you. And I thought it was beautiful. I thought it was like, it has literally stuck with me to this day, 10 years later, or probably not 10 years yet, but closing in on, he wanted to share the experience of what we were looking at rather than one of us turning around and seeing different things. And I thought it was beautiful. I love stuff like that. And I love, you know, seeing through the eyes of a friendship of you're looking together at the same things. So I think that's pretty cool. I think that's a great place to wrap this up. I've really enjoyed this conversation. I think it's been a lot of fun. Hope the listeners will enjoy it as well, as much as I did. So one final question for you today. If you had a dinner with anyone dead or alive, and we're going to assume they understand the workings of the internet, to explain what Bitcoin means to you and what you think it could mean to humanity, who would that be and why?
Oh man, that's a tough one. I got a weird answer for you. I'll just pull it out of my hat.
Chesterton.
G.K. Chesterton.
And who's CK or TK?
GK.
GK. Who is GK Chesterton?
A prolific writer who was just very toxic about the things he saw going on in his world of the day. But also he's written a lot of like philosophy and theological type stuff too. I can't do justice trying to explain why I would choose him. I can answer that better next time. Give me some time to think about it. But just suffice to say that like he was very cutting in his wit, but also had a lot of deep compassionate prescience of like love for the world and the things that mattered. And he directed that at like the large scale structures around humanity that were, he thought were going to propagate into things that weren't good for his country. But he also had a deep respect for like truth for what the human heart needs as individuals and families as well. I think he would really enjoy like what Bitcoin has become today. And he'd be like, kind of like you talk about Mark Twain would do really well on Twitter. Chesterton would do really well on Twitter.
Interesting. So what time period was he alive in?
Good question. I'm terrible with dates. That's one of the things about me that like people got to know. I'm like horrid at history. He was during one of the wars. He did a lot of writing, I think, in the United Kingdom. Don't quote me on that one.
Gotcha. Well, I'll
somewhere in the World War eras.
I'll do some research on him and I'll throw his Wikipedia page in the show notes or something like that, so the listeners can see him as well. Joel,
I pick him not because I've read his stuff most and know him that well, but because I think with his personality, it'd be the funnest like clashing of like who he is against like the world today versus what is emerging with Bitcoin.
That makes sense. Based on what you just said, it seems like you guys probably have a similar personality and would have some fun conversations to say the least.
Probably.
And this has been awesome conversation. I really appreciate you jumping on kind of last minute notice. Super fun. I've been looking forward to this since we met in Austin. Glad we made it happen. Let the listeners know where they can find you, and I'll make sure to have links to everything in the show notes.
Website of what I'm up to is just untappedgrowth.com. Most of the stuff I do just is out on Twitter. So just like at Untapped Growth, super simple.
Perfect. Like I said, it'll be in the bio or in the show notes, I guess. And thank you so much for your time today. Really, really a joy and a pleasure. And we'll chat soon, to say the least.
Pleasure, buddy.
Wow. What a fun episode that was with Joel. I truly hope you enjoyed it as much as I did while chatting with him. He sees the world in a very unique way, and it always makes for fun conversations. So, for the giveaway, I definitely did not forget. If you have listened this far, you now have a shot to win. I have some custom Dumbest Guy in the Room podcast t-shirts that I made, and will be giving away 3 of them. In order to qualify, you need to subscribe to the show on Apple Pods or Spotify, and then follow me on Twitter and send me a DM with your size. I will then select 3 random winners from the list. P.S. I will definitely pay for shipping inside the U.S., but if you are in another country, you will have to be willing to pay for shipping, in sats of course, if you win. Thanks again for joining me on another episode, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen, and always keep stacking sats. If you have any questions, you can find me at E3BTC on all platforms, or E3BTC.com. I will catch you next week with another episode. Peace. Take us away, bro.